Blog Talk Radio.
Gentlemen, Progressive News Network tonight. I'm your host, News Director Richard Spezak. We've got some important stories for you. And no, there's not a riot going on, but ladies and gentlemen, progressive activists are standing up to the abuses across the nation. Number one, this news item, I'm going to be doing the calendar first. As always, we've got an event on the 6th of February. It's called Flood the Court. The NDAA is going to court, and it's a very important story. I'm going to come back to that, but I've got some other brief announcements to make about things coming up. Space Coast progressives are having a gun control public safety expert panel presentation. That'll be Thursday, February 7th. It's up in the Melbourne area. Announcements at the 6:30 program begin at 7. Each expert panel member will speak briefly. Opening statements to be followed by discussion and an audience question and answer period. It's free and open to the public. It'll be at the Front Street Civic Center, 2205 South Front Street. That's Melbourne, Florida, the East Coast. Good people at Space Coast Progressive have an ongoing series of wonderful presentations. You should be involved. If you got any chance to get up there, you definitely should. Another important event. LegiCamp 2013. LegiCamp 2013 is the third annual gathering of progressive, which is held for the purpose of organizing action for the Florida legislative session. This unconference format of scheduling sessions is based on the interests of the attendees. Presenters will pitch their ideas to the group, and sessions will be planned according to those interests. Each session will be dedicated to planning specific legislative actions in response to various legislation. That'll be Saturday, February 9th, 2013, 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m., and that's Orlando at the City Hall. LegiCamp is hosted by Florida Progressives, a coalition which in 2011 organized the collective actions known as Awake the State. You can go to the Progressive website, and there's information. Just or look up LegiCamp.com, LegiCamp.com. Palm Beach Now will be hosting the 40th annual Susan B. Anthony Feminist of the Year Award, and that'll be Saturday the 10th. The Boynton Beach Democrats will be hosting a membership meeting Monday, February 4th, starting 7:30 at the Temple Sharai Shalom, and that's 9085 Hagen Ranch Road, Boynton Beach. Sean Miller, President, Palm Coast Billing Trades, will discuss contractors using out-of-state workers resulting in the loss of jobs for Florida union residents on taxpayer-funded jobs. Also, on a national scale, February 7th, Washington, D.C., the John Brennan rejection hearing. On February 8th, Washington, D.C., Beneath the Blindfold for a screening of a film. February 9th, the CIA protest for drone wars, and that's in D.C., also in D.C., a climate rally on the 17th. And on the 17th, 10 years of D.C. poets against the war. That's February 17th in Washington. Now the news. How do you keep consumers in the dark about the horrors of factory farms? By making it an act of terrorism for anyone to investigate animal cruelty, food safety, or environmental violations on the corporate-controlled farms that produce the bulk of our meat, eggs, and dairy products. Yes, Sinclair Lewis would be arrested today. Who better to write the Animal Ecological Terrorism Act designed to Protect Big Ag and Big Energy. Then the lawyer is on the Energy, Environment, and Agricultural Task Force at the corporate-funded infamous American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. New Hampshire, Wyoming, Nebraska are the latest states to introduce ag-gag laws aimed at preventing employees, journalists, or activists from exposing illegal or unethical practices on factory farms. Lawmakers in 10 other states introduced similar bills in 2011-2012. Laws passed in three of those states, Missouri, Iowa, and Utah, but consumer and animal welfare activists prevented the laws from passing in Florida, Illinois, Indiana, Minnesota, Nebraska, New York, and Tennessee. In all, six states now have ag-gag laws, including North Dakota, Montana, Kansas, all of which passed laws in the 1990-1991 before the term ag-gag was coined. Ag-gag laws passed 20 years ago were focused more on the deterring people from destroying property or stealing animals or settling them free. Today's ALEC-inspired bills take direct aim at anyone who tries to expose horrific acts of animal cruelty, etc. The Asahi Shimbun news from Fukushima. Environmental Ministry has received reports from Asahi Shimbun and others about 14 cases of shoddy decontamination work at Fukushima Prefecture. General contractors admitted to only three of those cases. Slipshod work caught in photographs and videos by Asahi Shimbun is just the tip of the iceberg. The ministry plans to release the results of its own investigations on January 18th. But if it continues to rely on the work of contractors, the actual situation will never become clear. Over 150 U.S. service members say the Fukushima radiation has triggered medical issues. Now the Defense Department abandons medical registry, leaving them on their own. The Department of Defense has decided to walk away from an unprecedented medical registry of nearly 70,000 American service members, civilian workers, and their families caught in the radioactive clouds billowing from the destroyed nuclear power plants of Fukushima Daiichi in Japan. The decision to cease updating the registry means that there will be no way to determine if patterns of health problems emerge from among the members of the Marines, Army, Air Force, Corps of Engineers, and Navy stationed at 63 installations in Japan with their families. In addition, it leaves thousands of sailors and Marines in the USS Ronald Reagan Carrier Strike Group 7 on their own when it comes to determining if any of them are developing problems caused by radiation exposure. So far, however, more than 150 servicemen and women who participated in the rescue mission since then have developed a variety of medical issues, including tumors, tremors, internal bleeding, and hair loss, which they feel were triggered by their exposure to radiation. They do not blame the Navy for their predicament, but are joining in an ever-expanding lawsuit against the Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, for providing false information to the U.S. officials about the extent of spreading radiation from the stricken reactors at Fukushima. And the decision by the Defense Department to abandon the registry leaves them on their own. Fukushima mom, five hospitals refuse to provide medical care to children. We can't be seen by a doctor when we want to be seen. It's just not right. The doctor said, it will be confusing if our results differ from the Fukushima Medical University. Isn't that nice? Thyroid examinations for children under 18 offered free of charge by Fukushima Prefecture. In order to watch over children's health, bring a sense of relief, is increasing anxiety of parents and guardians. Many are taking their children to hospitals outside the Fukushima Prefecture, looking for a second opinion. The reason for that is the insufficient explanation about results from the prefecture. A 60-year-old woman from Kawamatamachi, Fukushima, took her 4-year-old granddaughter to the Nakadori General Hospital in Akita City, Akita Prefecture, in June to determine palpatory and ultrasound examinations of a thyroid gland as well as blood tests for thyroid function. The family received the prefecture's examination results from Fukushima University in February, and all it said was, there are small nodules and cysts, fluid-filled sacs, but there is no need for secondary examination. They grew anxious about having to wait until the next examination 2 years later. They were upset when multiple cysts were confirmed at the Akita Hospital. The doctor recommended a follow-up examination 6 months later and told them, now there is a diagnosis, you'll be able to use insurance next time. However, there are quite a few cases of people traveling far for examinations after being denied medical care in Fukushima. A 38-year-old mother of two who evacuated to Azizu, Wakamatsuta City, called five hospitals in the city, yet no one agreed to examine them. She resented that It's just not right that we can't be seen by a doctor when we want to be seen. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that and more news in a little while. But first, I want to bring in our first guest, Mr. Dennis Campbell, producer of Worldview and also publisher of the UK Progressive. Dennis comes to us from across the water in the UK. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome our esteemed guest, international journalist, Mr. Dennis Campbell, host of Worldview, and among many other things. Dennis, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here, Rick.
Well, first I have to ask you, sir, tell us about your new project. Tell us about Worldview.
Well, for 42 weeks now, I have been contributing a segment that many of your listeners, I think, have probably seen called Worldview with Dennis Campbell to the David Packlund Show. And after many weeks of looking at this, David came to me, and he's affiliated with the Young Turks and Cenk Uygur. And they have a very interesting revenue model for generating shows that become YouTube clips that then become self-sustaining. And that's really what was attractive to me. I think at some level I had always wanted to put together a podcast. I've admired what you've done. I've admired what the folks over at World of Progress Radio and other shows have done. And I thought, gosh, it would be really good to be able to do something. But I also knew that it would be both an all-consuming effort as well as a real struggle to build an audience. And when David came to me, he said, well, you know, we're already getting a couple of 100,000, if not more, views off of the videos that you produced for our show. We'll promote your show through ours, so you'll get the benefit of that. The only thing then became a question of, you know, how many ways could I say yes? He's such a gracious young man, David is, and he's also smarter than, you know, 10 people put together. And, you know, to be able to be a part of his network and be able to also pick his brain and know that neither David nor any of my good friends are just going to blow smoke at me. I've been getting some wonderfully brutal feedback on the first few clips that were there. And every single comment was right on and was almost immediately incorporated the next day. And so now here we are on day 15 of this new venture with 200 subscribers to Worldview Show and some 3,000 plus video views. And we seem to be moving, touch wood, I'll hit myself on the head there, in the right direction. And we've had some amazing guests, and we have an amazing couple of weeks coming up. I'm going up to the University of Warwick next week. I think it would be pronounced in the States Warwick, like the city in Rhode Island. And I'll be on a panel there with Wael Abbas. And Wael is probably, after Wael Gonim, the man that wrote the book Revolution 2.0 and who was in prison for 12 of the 18 days, was released, and suddenly 48 hours later Mubarak was gone. Wael Abbas is a notorious Egyptian blogger, and he's agreed to do an interview for Worldview. So it really is moving at a pace faster than I can keep up with. There are moments I sit here and I wonder, okay, what next? And then boom, the phone rings and off we go in another direction. But we're getting the right kind of people. I was at a peace conference this morning up at Atlantic College and met, and his name is gone, but this man has worked with Matt. It'll come to me. He's worked with the USAID and the UN and others in some of the hottest spots of the world, from Kosovo to Pakistan, et cetera, talking about, you know, how you bring understanding, which then brings peace. So it's been a fascinating ride so far. Our goal is to have three interviews each week from really good people. We've got right now Ahmed Tharawat, who's an Egyptian based in Minnesota. He's the lead story, and he's talking about the Egyptian Revolution 2 years on. And I recorded an interview yesterday with a young gentleman by the name of Adel El Adawi, and he runs a massive blog called Egyptian Student Abroad, which is EgyptianAbroad.com. And so he gives me the perspective of the youth who were the ones that actually started the revolution that are feeling a bit disillusioned right now. And there's just more to come. I've got the journalism professor who was kicked out of the United Arab Emirates for, you know, suggesting that they need to be a bit more open with their treatment of the press. I've got lots of very interesting people coming up in the next few weeks. So I'm really, it's exciting. There's a ton of work to be done because you really want to make sure you get your questions right. We'll work hard at it. And I'm having a ball.
Well, that's great. It's always good to see a good journalist digging in to an exciting plate full of guests and questions. Before we come over to some of the things going on in the States, I did want to ask you about a couple things from the European perspective, sir.
Sure.
Right now, there's been so much discussion, even some of it's filtered through the American press, about the economic woes of Europe is putting even more pressure on the British relationship with Europe. Are there any things we should watch out for in, say, the next month or two on that issue?
Wouldn't say the next month or two, but last week, or actually during this week now, it was supposed to have been last Saturday. Prime Minister Cameron was supposed to travel to the Netherlands to deliver his Europe ultimatum speech, but a combination of bad weather and the raid on the oil facility in Algeria postponed that till the middle part of this week, and he delivered his speech in London. He has a very far right-wing fringe of his own Tory party, which never wanted to become a part of the European Union in the first place. You know, there's a very upper crust group of people in the conservative Tory party. They wanted nothing to do with Europe in the first place, and they have been fighting for or looking for a fight everywhere they possibly can. And one of the ways in which they've been looking for a fight is they've wanted now for years to have a referendum in Europe that's an in or out of the European Union referendum. And quite frankly, if it was to become a referendum vote, the UK would probably end up leaving Europe altogether. Now, he's promised to not do anything until after the election in 2017. But it's still a bit of saber rattling. Now, some say it's designed to scare Europe into action to sort of let member states do a bit more on their own. They tend to chafe at what the European Union wants them to do. But others see this as a very dangerous brinkmanship move. One of the people I interviewed just last week, and he was featured on the channel, is Adrian Masters. And Adrian is the political director at ITV, and he's had me on his program, Sharp End, and we've known each other since when he was back at the BBC. So I called and asked him if he would come on and chat a little bit about this in particular. Your viewers can find it very easily, you know, with the, you know, is the UK nudging itself towards the door? That's the clip name, and Adrian Masters of ITV is interviewed. And he gave a very good insight as to how it looks. If people in Wales, which is where I live, don't support this move at all. As a matter of fact, we tend to be more not just Eurocentric, but outside of the UK-centric. And I think that's part of the nature of things here. So it's a very interesting time. I don't know where it will ultimately end up. I think that what's happened is you've got France and you've got Germany exerting probably what some would consider to be undue influence because they are on the single currency, the euro, whereas the United Kingdom never joined it. So when it comes to many aspects of financial policy, trade policy, we're kind of left on the outside looking in because we kept the sterling. hindsight being 2020, was probably the smartest thing we ever did, because a number of countries that are in the single currency, such as the Netherlands, such as Germany, secretly probably wish, because the mark was very strong and the guilder was also very, very strong, that they had their own currency. But, you know, they're stuck in it and they're trying to make best of it.
Let me ask you about two other stories that the internationalists, a twig of the American political tree, have noticed in terms of European stories. There's quite a hubbub, as it were, about the French intervention in Mali. And when you've got, on the one hand, the tug and pull of Eastern European problems, the economic problems there, to see this international action of France in Africa certainly has raised a few eyebrows over here. How's it look from Europe?
It's raised eyebrows here too, Rick. really, at the end of the day, we're not really quite sure what they're up to. It looks as though, you know, the mission is largely counterterrorism in nature, that they're there to support the Mali government. There was a clear and present danger, at least in their minds, a real chance that that nation would fall into control of the Al-Qaeda in Africa group that was exerting a lot of pressure in the Mali capital. That said, there's so much that we're not sure of, because we don't really know what the mission is, how long they intend to stay, and they've gotten a few African nations, but most of the countries here have just sort of taken kind of a hands-off approach. We say we support them and we will help them because we have to, as members of the European Union, and for the most part we're sitting back going, I don't know, I don't think we want to get ourselves in a ground war in Central Africa. That's something that is just of absolutely zero interest to any of the governments that are part of the Union.
You know, I think the particularly interesting aspect of this to me is right quick we've seen terrorist action at a petroleum facility. We hear stories about offshore oil in Mali, and with that that hostage taking at that petroleum facility in Algeria, it looks to me like the terrorists are kind of tearing away the delicate illusion that this is about nation building or democracy, and they're bringing the focus right on the what I'm going to call the colonial resource extraction component that is so much part of the economic life of Africa. Is that part of the talk over there?
You know, we don't really talk that much in those terms, but it is always an issue, if you know what I mean. It's always something that is to be considered when you look at anything to do with Africa, anything to do with I'm talking about Europe in general, as well as the United States, have always had a colonial empire sort of building view of the world. And what got most of the countries into trouble with the Arab Spring was that for decades, some might even say at least a century, if not longer, countries like the United States, the United Kingdom, France, the Netherlands, Germany, turned a blind eye to the human rights abuses that were going on in that part of the world. And they did so because it suited their economic and political stability needs. It's kind of a situation where the devil you know is better than anything that else that could possibly come its way. I had this conversation with, I think it was Ahmed Tharwat, during our interview. I said, you know, as long as a country behaved itself, the worst that could happen was they would come off with, and I was with David Packman just on Thursday, he was asking about the delivery of fresh F-18s and helicopters to the Egyptian regime, which is now effectively run by the Muslim Brotherhood, and what concerns were there. And I said basically that the State Department of the United States and the Foreign Secretary's office here have but one goal. That is to maintain peace on the southern border of Israel and the northern border of Egypt. They want that fragile peace to keep going. They want to keep the Suez Canal open, free, freely operating and not causing any problems. So when you deal with corrupt governmental regimes, State Departments, foreign secretaries tend to look the other way when there are abuses against people living within a country. And that, sadly, has always been the case. And it goes all the way back to long before the Arab Spring. There was a young gentleman in Alexandria who was severely beaten by the security forces, and he died, and he became a martyr and the cause for Egyptian revolution. But what happened with this poor young man as a martyr is that the State Department had to take a step back. They had to slow down a few transactions. They had to publicly slap Mubarak on the wrist, "Naughty boy, don't do that again." And then a few weeks later, it was business as usual. And at the end of the day, in the United States currently, and it doesn't matter what administration is in power, it will always be business as usual, because you have a military-industrial complex that's being fed, you have an oil complex that's being fed, and those two will always control what goes on in that area.
Let me ask you this. We're hearing more and more the saber rattling that had been so attendant around the name Iran. We now hear around Mali and around African issues. This is key to now we're supplying the French with some equipment. I understand that there's drones going that way too. Is the issue of drones part of the public discourse in Britain?
Not as much as in the U.S., and even in the U.S. it's not quite as much as it probably should be. Did you see The Daily Show last evening?
Yes, I did.
There was an absolutely brilliant, and that's a woman I'd love to get on the show. She's an MIT professor working on these pilotless flight initiatives and ventures. And I came out of that with a slightly different view on drones. I'm not a big fan of drones used for warfare or for the purposes of spying on individuals. And that said, there were some fascinating concepts that she was advancing and discussing. You know, she's absolutely right about the Airbus aircraft being virtually fly-by-wire machines. I mean, the pilots are just there in case something goes wrong. And there's more and more of the technology being used for commerce and to move things. That fascinates me. But unfortunately, you say drones and you think of what we've been doing in Pakistan, what we've been doing in Afghanistan, what we've been doing, in parts of the world. And the ethical questions cannot be easily resolved of somebody basically flying a pilotless aircraft from thousands of miles away, dropping a bomb, and being 100% certain that they're hitting the target they want to hit. That's so hard. I don't know what the answer is there.
Well, in the discussions that I participated in, the most common pro-drone argument that I've heard, and it's been typically advanced by people with some military experiences, they say, if we're going to be there, better that our soldiers shouldn't be dying. And I have some sympathy with that argument. No one likes to see human life lost. But I think human life lost, when you only put an American military face on it, begs the question.
I agree. It's one of those issues where I don't know where the line is anymore. And I think the U.S. lost its moral authority all the way back in the Bush administration when they chose to embrace torture. That was where the moral high ground was lost. Now, is it completely lost because you can use a drone to... I mean, the one person in this world you do not want to be right now is an Al-Qaeda number two.
The question that supersedes all of those arguments, though, in this, and I have to admit, it's the history in the long run, but if you look down the road, whether it's 5 years or 10 years, once you've made it okay, and we can all just let it pass, that you can go send a bomb into a third country or a second country, and without declaring war, just go in and take out people. Now, how long is it going to take before someone turns that around?
And well, that's just the issue. That's the big issue. And not just turn it around in terms of a bomb. I mean, you know, if you think of some of the chemical agents, I mean, you know, forget a Hellfire missile. What if all of a sudden, you know, these things are affordable. They come in kits. You can build them yourself.
Exactly. She said
it becomes an anthrax delivery device. I thought that was a great quote she said last night.
That's right.
I looked at that and I thought, wow, that's really, you know, that's another level of thought that I don't think anybody looked at when they first entered in here. And now the very real possibility, you know, of several of these rogue states being able to, you know, or to just take a dirty bomb, you know, and fly it in on one of these things. I mean, there's just so many things. And there's also a huge part of me that says, you know what, I got too much to worry about now. I can't spend my life worrying about, you know, the what ifs and the doomsday scenarios. There's just too many ways in which we could possibly be wiped off. I have to have a little bit of faith that, you know, intelligence and human nature is going to take over and stop a lot of it. And it's a different world than what it was 10, 15 years ago. We both know that.
Yeah, well, let's turn to some of the stateside issues that I'm looking forward to getting your perspective on. I don't want to take too much of your time, but I think we cannot continue without mentioning the Secretary of State's performance in Congress. Did you catch any of that?
I've seen a couple of the clips. I mean, it was the sort of thing where I could have put C-SPAN on all day, but I was just way too busy. But the you know, the dressing down of was it Ron Johnson, the guy from Wisconsin? You know, that was brilliant. And they are so afraid of Hillary Clinton running for president in 2016, they're beside themselves because, you know, I don't care how many states you go in and change the Electoral College, she will absolutely crucify these tired old white men.
Well, you know, I had to laugh. I was fortunate enough to be able to hear about 4 hours of her testimony. And
Rick, you need to get a life, Rick.
my diet for political spice was more than fulfilled. I watched her talk at the House, and you know, I kept thinking, did these guys forget the fact that she's lived with Bill Clinton for all these years? You know, do you think her debating skills have been honed? I mean, they were so outclassed, it wasn't even funny. And I'm not a terribly big fan of Miss Clinton. You know, she has her good sides and her bad sides. She's way too conservative for me, way too prepared to go with the standard war thinking, and I have no truck with that. But just in terms of a human being confronted by a bunch of bullies, they were just not in her league.
Yeah, and the funny thing is that, you know, the more condescending and the more combative they got, the smaller and the sillier they looked. And, you know, it's just, you know, you hear about this wonderful conference where they went away for the weekend and supposedly solved all of their party's problems, but I don't think the Republican GOP Tea Party has solved anything.
Well, I heard a synopsis of some of those discussions, and they said, well, it's not their message that's wrong, it's just their delivery. Well, honey, it's not the delivery,
nope.
although that has its problems. You know, go ahead.
I think Texas is in play this time. I really do. I think you're going to see some major shifts of some red states, particularly if Hillary runs, because she is liked by, you know, first of all, it won't be just Democratic women, it'll be Republican women that will want to elect a woman president, and she's the most qualified. And by elect a woman president, not Sarah Palin. You know, Republican moderates. I mean, Chris Christie will wear on people, and he, you know, and then you're left with Jeb Bush. And Jeb Bush, you're going to actually ask the nation to elect a third Bush inside of three presidents or five presidents. I can't see it happening. You know, the name and the brand is so tarnished no matter how good Jeb is with, you know, a few Hispanics in Miami, that's not going to happen.
Well, I guess you heard that the filibuster discussions basically went nowhere.
I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised. I mean, that's such a double-edged sword, Rick.
It is. It is, absolutely.
Because if you do something to fix it, then you lose the ability to use it as a tool yourself when the Republicans take over the Senate. And I just, I on the one hand, I don't like the way in which the Republicans have used it, and I think they've been named and shamed and embarrassed, and some of these tweaks actually aren't bad. They will actually, you know, limit what they can do, and it will give, you know, Harry a bit of a nuclear option on something. So it, I think Harry was dumb like a fox this time, as it usually is. So I want to watch and see how that one develops and see if they actually have the guts now that the focus and the attention is on it to continue to be so obstructionist.
One last question I'm going to ask you, sir, is, you know, we've dodged and weaved around this fiscal cliff. There's still a large group of people in D.C. who want to see more austerity, more austerity. What's your take on how things are evolving? What's it look like from overseas?
Well, you know, from here, the one thing you don't want to have is more austerity. I mean, austerity has killed our economy. We're in the midst of a triple-dip recession. We've had a situation where just this past week in Davos, the IMF chair and several others told George Osborne, who's our version of Tim Geithner. He's the Treasury Secretary, but it goes by the fancy name here of Chancellor of the Exchequer. And they basically said, look, you've got to ease back from your austerity budget. You're killing your economy. And these are economists from all over the world at the Davos Economic Forum. And both he and Cameron basically doubled down. And, you know, they're destroying the NHS, the National Health Service. They're destroying the social network. They're destroying everything they can. All of their pals are winning. And I cannot understand where labor is and where the outrage is, because, you know, if this were happening in the USA, there would be riots in the street. And here people just go, oh, well, you know, what are you going to do? It's just strange. You want to avoid austerity at all costs, because it is something that is a false straw man argument. There's nothing there. It's just the Republicans' desire to destroy Social Security, Medicaid, et cetera. It's not real. You can still borrow money at a rate of 0%, so you're paying less than 0% over time on the future value of that money. You should be investing in infrastructure. You should be doing everything you can to create jobs. You should be doing everything you can to advance education, because that will put more people to work, and your tax issues and your deficit issues take care of themselves, because now your revenues are up. And the reason you grew, and the funny thing is that the numbers I saw this week show that the spending thing is under control. You know, this president has actually reduced the deficit 3 of the 4 years he's been in office. So that's not the issue. And it's not these long-term legacy payments that everybody tries to make is the issue. It's just a simple matter of, you know, getting out there and starting the economy going. But they're so afraid of the Republican Party to see the U.S. economy do well, they'll actually conspire against and work against their own party, their own best interests, and moving the American people forward. It's the most bizarre thing I've ever seen.
Well, thank you, my friend. Best of luck on your new show, Worldview, and they can catch it on YouTube, right?
YouTube.com/Worldview Show, one word. And, it's going to be an exciting time. We'll have to do this ourselves, Rick. We'll have to find an issue that we can internationalize and get you on the Worldview Show as well.
Well, thank you so much, my friend, and best of luck.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon, Dennis. Bye-bye. That was our guest, Dennis Campbell, from the UK Progressive and the YouTube channel Worldview. I want to get back to this NDAA, which is something that people don't know enough about. The NDAA, a lawsuit over the provision in the National Defense Authorization Act, will be back in federal court on 10 a.m. February 6, 2013, awaiting decision on an injunction prohibiting indefinite detention of civilians without trial or charge. A group of academics, journalists, and activists filed suit last year over the NDAA, alleging that the provision suspending due process rights and threatened the First Amendment protections. In a landmark ruling last September, the plaintiffs, former New York Times war correspondent Chris Hedges, Revolution Truth founder Jennifer Tangerine Bolin, Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, linguist and author Noam Chomsky, Icelandic parliamentarian Brigitte Jóndóttir, U.S. Day of Rage founder Alexa O'Brien, and Occupy London activist Kai Wargalia were awarded a permanent worldwide injunction against the provision by Judge Catherine Forrest of the Southern District of New York, Second Circuit. In her ruling, Judge Forrest, an Obama appointee, challenged the Justice Department's attorney for refusing to provide assurances that journalists and activists would not be indefinitely detained under the provisions for exercising First Amendment rights. Not once in any of its submissions, but in this action or either the March or August hearing, has the government said First Amendment activities are not covered and could not be encompassed by 1021. This court rejects the government's suggestion that American citizens can be placed in military detention indefinitely for acts they could not predict might subject them to detention and have as their sole remedy a habeas petition. That scenario dispenses with a number of guaranteed rights. Despite including a signing statement expressing deep reservations over the indefinite detention provision and promising not to use such powers against American citizens, President Obama immediately appealed Judge Forrest's ruling and sought an emergency stay on the injunction, claiming irreparable harm would be incurred by the U.S. if the government lacked the ability to indefinitely detain civilians under Section 1021. This is the final battle between the restoration of due process, along with our most cherished civil liberties and the imposition of a military state, said Chris Hedges. If we lose this battle, we will be vulnerable to being seized on American soil by the military, stripped of due process, and held in indefinite detention in military facilities, including our offshore penal colonies. It is up to federal judges now to pull us back from the brink. Our legal challenge to Section 1021B of the NDAA is one of defining moments in our era. The suit has been joined by over two dozen organizations and individuals who have filed amicus curiae briefs in support of the plaintiff's claim that 1021B of the NDAA is overbroad and facially unconstitutional. One such supporting brief, filed by Karen and Ken Korematsu, children of Fred Korematsu and each emissary in this case, draws a chilling comparison between the indefinite detention under auspices of the War on Terror and the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Korematsu remains on the pages of our legal and political history. As a legal precedent, it is now recognized as having very limited application. As historical precedent, it stands as a constant caution that in times of war or declared military necessity, our institutions must be vigilant and protecting constitutional guarantees. It stands as a caution that in times of distress, the shields of military necessity and national security must not be used to protect government actions from close scrutiny and accountability. It stands as a caution that in times of international hostility and antagonisms, our institutions, legislative, executive, and judicial, must be prepared to exercise their authority to protect all citizens from the petty fears and prejudices that are so easily abused. In opposition to the plaintiffs, senior senators John McCain, Lindsey Graham, and Kelly Ayotte have utilized the amicus process to file a brief in support of the government's use of 1021 of the NDA and have taken the unusual step in filing a motion requesting 10 minutes of oral argument time in February 6th, the 2012 proceedings, claiming the need for a Senate body to be represented in a court when it comes to indefinite detention. Plaintiff attorneys are awaiting word on whether the second court will grant this motion. Update. On Thursday, January 31st, 2012, attorneys for the plaintiffs received notice that McCain, Graham, Ayotte were awarded a 5-minute oral argument at the proceeding. To compensate for this, the Second Court Circuit also added 5 minutes onto the plaintiff's argument, allowing for 20 minutes total. A bipartisan coalition of groups backing this lawsuit, including Demand Progress, Revolution Truth, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and the 10th Amendment Center, are calling on members and supporters to join the plaintiffs in court. Activists promoting a call to flood the courthouse have already received over 300 RSVPs from activists and supporters of the plaintiffs. The plaintiff and lawsuit coordinator, Tangerine Bolin, will lead a press conference upon the adjournment of the court session. Speakers will include Tangerine Bolin, Daniel Ellsberg, Chris Hedges, Bruce Afrin, Alexa O'Brien, Cornell West, Thomas Drake, Jocelyn Radick, and a number of others working to prevent indefinite detention and restore civil liberties. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a critical issue. And now, without any further ado, let me bring on our first guest. Welcome.
Hello, it's Gwen.
Hello, Gwen. How are you tonight?
I'm doing fine. I'm listening to you. Actually, I read this, the Sparrow Project post, yes?
Yes.
It's incredible. Let's hope that, Mr. McCain will face a whole lot different rebuttal than he did with his questioning of Hegel.
Well, you know, I can't help but be reminded that some of the political commentators have pointed out that a man whose judgment encompassed Sarah Palin cannot be allowed to proceed without some chiding on his judgment.
Yeah, and the thing is, the guy is just, he's posturing, and that kind of posturing is, it's bad for the country, but we know this. It, just like NDAA, it's bad for the country, and getting to it is... The folks that have brought this suit really deserve our support. Anyone who's near New York, the city, on Wednesday should get down there to the Thurgood Marshall Building and support this.
Absolutely. Gwen, so tell me, you're a busy woman with so many irons in the fire. What stories are you following closely today?
Well, today I was actually following the Super Bowl.
I understand that's a sporting event.
It is. I was following the sporting event. I'll tell you what, one of the most important things that I've been trying to do since the beginning of the year, Rick, is to focus or find a focus onto the positive. What are the positive things that are happening around us? To bring that to over to Here Be Monsters and any place that I come on and speak to a group of people through this medium of indie alter media as we have. I want to bring something positive to it. The most positive thing I can say about the NDAA and the suit going on and the last minute approach by Mr. McCain and who's his other
Graham? Mr. Lindsey Graham.
Lindsey Graham and I wish I could. I'd love to do that rebuttal. that's the most positive thing I can say right now is that they're not going to face someone who's going to posture back by keeping their mouth shut because they're not very aware. And I think this is Mr. Hegel's problem. He's not too aware of which way he can wag because of the present administration. It's a terrible place to be in. He did not look very good in front of those cameras, did he?
Well, I understand that he was told to just lie down and take it, no matter what. That the White House said, look, just don't raise a fuss, whatever. But you would think that knowing what kind of heat he was going to get, no matter who the president picked was going to take a lot of grief from the Republicans. You'd have thought they'd given him a few exit lines, a few nice quips. But clearly this is a group that either has nothing positive to say or really can't think. Outthink Republicans.
Here's the thing. I've not seen I've basically not seen a fight that this president can't run away from, and it seems to slide downhill, except for one place. I've noticed that the leaving Secretary of State has kept out of the way of those slings, and has kept her, I read it today, that she's kept her activist nature tamped down, and you got to wonder where, and perhaps this is my positive aspect, you have to wonder where Hillary Clinton is going to come from in the future. She was never really what I thought of as a complete corporate dupe. And it was her universal health care that I thought was just tremendous when she first brought it up so long ago. These are positive things, you know. These are positive little backgrounds that we could point to and say, perhaps is something there. Everything else that's coming in front of the cameras right now out of our political system is very gloomy. I'm going to just say gloomy.
Well, I think that one of the positive things you could say about the NDA controversy right now is that they weren't rounded up and secreted to an undisclosed location.
We can still
contend these points. Isn't that nice?
It's coming damn close to not be, you know, it's all going to come out in the wash on Wednesday, or perhaps they'll kick it to the side again. Either way, there's going to be a lot of big media coverage because there has to be. It's a major case. Am I correct?
Well, I'd like to think that. I'd like to think that it would be on the American public's radar, but, you know, there may be a big basketball game or some starlet getting out of a car the wrong way, and all those little things like constitutional issues will, you know, be brushed aside for something, you know, really important.
Yeah.
On another issue I was going to ask you about, we've seen a different focus of Occupy. I had a wonderful guest on here, Susan Hawaii, who's very involved with fighting the foreclosure side of the Occupy issue. What have you been looking at with Occupy recently?
Well, actually, I've been, in the last 2 months, I've been in a transition mode, moving my business. So I've been very light on any kind of activity on the political side. But I will tell you this, that the focus on the foreclosure problems that are currently underway around, especially locally, that's why I had to move. Occupy is doing a tremendous job. I'll tell you also, the Occupy Wall Street movement in New York, those groups up there, if it hasn't been for them, the people on Staten Island and parts of the Bronx and Queens and parts of New Jersey would still be without so much. It was a mobilization right past FEMA by Occupy. I think that speaks so much about what a community is willing to do.
Well, you know, this kind of reaction, and I think you point to it very wisely. When you look at what our government's resources could bring to bear, when you look at who was actually there for those people, the spectacle of the Republicans posturing over the damage of Sandy on the Northeast, you know, it speaks volumes about their values.
Well, and that's the thing. You know, you and I and so many others, I've come to know so many other wonderful people who are doing, you know, the same grasp of independent and alternative media in their own way and in smaller ways, much smaller ways than the big boys. But you know what? We're out here pointing towards the value of our humanity and how we can embrace one another and the good things that we're all doing to stand up to the inhumanity that our, quote, leadership is up there posturing with right now. And what you say about how the Republicans, but how much better were the Democrats who just stood by and let it happen? It's like those Democrats that sat in that questioning of Hagel the other day, who just, you know, sort of slapped some white paint over him at the end. I mean, oh my goodness. There's an old saying about growing a set.
Well,
I mean,
I watched the Sunday shows, I always do, to see what the mainstream media is prepared to discuss. And of course, you know, we heard the same tired discussion of economic policy with a whole range of discussion from all the way from A to B almost.
Chris, they did a good job.
And then when the Hagel hearings came up, they did mention in passing that, you know, of all the things, we've got several wars going on. We've got an expanded semi-secret war going on in Africa. We've got the ongoing Afghan, Pakistan, Iraq debacle. And there's no time to discuss that. They want to rehash what his talking points were when he dared to suggest that maybe we should be paying some attention to the – to the issues of Israel in 10 years ago. Boggles the mind.
But that's another issue that I keep my eye on. That's something I've kept my eye on for months now, years, but really in the last few months, and even in the last week, what Israel has been doing with Palestine and the Gaza Strip is just, it's unconscionable. And they were actually ousting people on World Observance of Holocaust Day last week. Did you know that? And it's crazy. The UN has actually recognized Palestine and is recognizing that Israel is breaking the law, pardon me, by continuing to encroach and not to remove the settlers and to allow more settlers in. They're putting more settlers in there. I mean, they're just inching them. It's like watching them inch them out the plank, you know? They're getting ready to get shoved right off the edge of the plank into the water. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Of course you do. I've been watching that one. Oh, my goodness. And a lot of people in this country are watching. Because as I was saying before, there are so many like Occupy and the work they do with foreclosure. I mean, you would think there's not such a big foreclosure problem anymore from the lack of news coverage on it, and yet it's overwhelming. In some states, it's just taking whole sections of communities out, and they're not talking about it at all.
No, and we've got this pipeline that is going to be threatening the whole United States so that the oil companies can make more profit to sell their products overseas. And what little is coveraged is that these environmentalists are calling into question the ability of these oil companies to just make obscene profits while they take those tax benefits.
Well, I saw an extremely interesting video. I believe that Dennis Traynor with Acronym TV put out of a young man who stood up in front of and chained himself to the XL Pipeline companies at Canada's, the company there that's behind it. Sorry, it's slipping my mind at the moment. They were giving a talk on their safety record, and this young man chained himself to the platform and began to spout out how many leaks per day this pipeline is already doing in the United States of America. And, of course, there was no coverage, and they, you know, sent for security to unbolt him and probably put the boy in jail. These kinds of things used to get some coverage, and there is a great deal of activism going on out there that's getting absolutely no coverage. And current television, I saw a a coverage of Charlie Rose speaking to Al Gore this week, and Al Gore talking about how Fox News is just glorified propaganda machine, which we all know is true, but I thought that was high talk from a low-down source myself. I give no respect to the man any longer, and current television is an excellent example of why. However, he did one thing good. He sold it to Al Jazeera. And
yep.
I think Al Jazeera is a credible, newsworthy organization. I look forward to seeing them. Hope they give Matt Taibbi a job, and it'd be wonderful to hear Keith Olbermann again.
Yep. You know, and it's funny, I hear the casual observers of the news, too many people that I run into say, oh, Al Jazeera, that sounds like Al-Qaeda. Clearly Gore has sold out to the Arab villains and terrorists. And I said,
yeah,
you
there's
know,
a lot of that going on with people who don't understand.
It's really unfortunate that history and geography are so poorly taught in our schools, and people have to understand, just like there's more than one flavor of Christianity, there's many flavors of Islam and Buddhism as well. And to hope that there was a little more sophistication sometimes seems like a fool's errand.
Well, and the other thing is that for the last 2 years, if you want to get the straight facts from that, you could be sure of it from Al Jazeera English.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was another interesting story that popped up on my radar a couple days ago. I've got a coming up interview with a woman who is working to expose the TSA for the abusive organization that it is. And there was a picture on her website of a young man, I don't know if you caught this, who dared to write the Fourth Amendment on his chest. And when the TSA went to scan him, he took off his shirt, he took off his pants, and he was just there with his Fourth Amendment. And he was arrested, of course, for causing
really?
A ruckus. The court threw out his charges. But, of course, he was detained, and, of course, he missed his flight. One more long history of abuses of the TSA's right to security.
Well, and this is an okay to rubber stamp by the White House. You can put that all back at Bush's White House. It's been followed through very elegantly by the Obama White House. It's like DHS. Giving all of the metropolitan police organizations the attitude adjustment that is now got, you know, the people of several cities and towns suffering their bullying.
Absolutely. Any other stories you've been focusing on?
What I was saying about Palestine has been hitting home a lot lately. And, of course, one other that I really am remiss because I didn't bring it right up is Idle No More. And First Nations and Indigenous people all over the world banding together like Occupy did with Global Revolution. All these things are still ongoing, and Idle No More and groups of Occupy combine themselves and do a lot of networking. There's been some extraordinarily large demonstrations. This is all it came out of Canada, but it's about Indigenous communities and First Nations, especially in the Americas, or what we call the Americas. Boy, you know, you got to be careful how you speak anymore, because labeling is becoming very important. We can make impressions with the correct labels. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Gwen, if you could hold on 1 minute, I'm going to bring on Lori Price from Citizens for Legitimate Government and let her talk for a few minutes, then we'll do our roundtable, okay?
Sure.
Hello, Lori, welcome.
Hi there, how are you?
Very good, very good. Yourself?
Good, thanks. Thank you for having me on your program.
Well, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the Citizens for Legitimate Government.
Sure. It's not a birther group, first of all, because the name sounds like, you know, in contemporary times that's what it would be, but it's not. It was established in 2000 in December, and as we know, what happened in December 2000 was what we perceive as a coup with the election having won by Al Gore but given to George W. Bush regardless. And so that's where the name comes from, and the website is legitgov.org. And we compile news stories of the day and put them on the site, and then every day or every other day, we send out a summary of all those stories in a newsletter, and, you know, we hope to get people involved in various actions that come about, although there hasn't been much protest against Obama recently, sadly. But anyway, that's what the site is about.
What stories are you covering right now?
Well, today's events were we try to find things that aren't covered, although obviously if there's an event dominating the news, the landscape will cover it, but we try to get stories that get less coverage, that people should know about. Like we spent a lot of time on Fukushima, things like that. So today we have a small item that mini helicopter drone for UK troops in Afghanistan, for example. You know, that these drones are proliferating and the size of them is shrinking and they're going to be everywhere soon. And so, for example, that would be a story we have up and things like that. A little bit obscure, although not, you know, so obscure nobody could find it, but we try to bring to light stories that are getting less coverage, stories and topics, less coverage.
I noticed that you've got stories on the war in Pakistan and stories on the Afghanistan war. You know, it seems to me that given all the turmoil in Pakistan, I'm really kind of surprised that it's not more in the news. I mean, we actually have some kind of debate about a new State Department leader, a new Defense Department leader, and yet there's almost no discussion whatsoever of Pakistan or Afghanistan. Now, do you think that's kind of curious?
Yes, it's curious how some nominees get a lot of discussion and others don't. The most controversial nominee of Barack Obama is John Brennan, who had nothing to say about the torture. He didn't protest against it, the waterboarding, rather, what some call torture. And now, you know, there's no discussion on him. However, there's a discussion of what Hagel said and Chuck Hagel said in 1978, you know, whatever, years ago. Now, yes, all comments should be of relevance. When they're said, they should be discussed. But we, for example, why don't we hear about John Brennan at all? I guess nobody has a problem with him, apparently, for some reason.
Well, it seems that much of the discussion of our security state has been wiped clean from the nation's media, with the exception of some progressive outlets. I know that the story of the ongoing siege of Julian Assange, the ongoing trial, something short of a speedy trial, I might point out, of the of Private Manning. Are these things that hit the Citizens for Legitimate website?
Absolutely. We try to cover Julian Assange as much as possible and Private Bradley Manning and so forth. And also Jeremy Hammond, the alleged Strat 4 hacker, who was a real hero. And, you know, I, in fact, started a satellite Facebook group, Free Jeremy Hammond, by the way. almost 1,000 people in that group now. But just to say, we try to bring his plight to light. And John Kiriakou, pardon my pronunciation.
Right.
You know, these whistleblowers, they get some coverage in the media. There are some events that don't seem to get anything. I think the rise of the private security state is the biggest issue right now. You know,
there seems to be unlimited funds in that
arena.
There seems to be unlimited funds for mercenaries.
Right, and there was an obscure item I covered, and I can't put the date on. I'm guessing like a month ago, but I'm not sure. The Blackwater has a huge, well, they changed their name a few times, Academy and all this other stuff. But anyway, I still call them Blackwater. Anyway, they got a huge contract, I think $25 billion to stay in Afghanistan until 2015. So, you know, you do the math. I thought we're out in 14, so I guess we're going to stay a little longer. And, you know, once they, if you're getting billions of dollars for the contract and you don't have scruples, what would you do if you don't want that contract to end? Create little problems so that you're asked to stay, you know, beyond that. So they'll be doing little things there, in my opinion, to cause a need for them to stay, and then they'll get the money because it's billions of dollars. You think they're going to have integrity and just say, oh, we're done, bye.
They're Can't imagine.
Stay, right?
Could I ask you to talk a little bit about Jeremy Hammond?
Sure. Yes, Jeremy Hammond started in 2004 speaking out against the Iraq War. I think he was in high school then. He was from Illinois, Chicago area, I believe. And he had some things to say during the one of the DEFCON events, the hacker conferences about online democracy and so forth. He led a walkout of his high school classmates during the Iraq War, I think in 2003. And then he allegedly leaked some thousands of pages of documents of the defense contractor STRATFOR, which had some very, by the way, there were some documents and there were some very negative things about Julian Assange saying he'd make a, quote, nice bride in prison, unquote, stuff like that. And so he was arrested and charged with a bunch of counts and he's sitting in jail now. And I think he couldn't get bail for some reason, although I don't know. Other people seem to get bail, I guess. Hacking.
Oh, shit. Oops. Excuse me. We had a little break in the conversation. Let me bring on our another guest, Susan Nylon. Susan, welcome.
Hi, Rich. How are you?
Very good. And yourself?
I'm doing quite fine, thank you.
How's things on the Nylon Report? What stories are you covering these days?
Well, I'm covering another local election, so that's been our big focus. We have an election that's coming up in a couple of weeks, and we have six candidates that are vying for two seats. So we haven't had a break yet in the election process.
I noticed that you've been on the Facebook looking for feedback from the local community and looking for questions.
Yeah, in addition to the stuff that I do on the radio, I've been asked to moderate quite a few debates. So I'm always looking for what the public has an interest in. And, you know, but right now we're focused on all the local issues, such as, you know, the police pensions and concurrency and development, things like that.
Well, I think that speaks very highly of your ability to be perceived as an equal oriented person. No. Not really leaning one way or another.
In the community, everybody knows that I'm a progressive, and I'm pretty open about that. In fact, I am speaking on a panel in front of the Sarasota Patriots, which are a well-known Tea Party group, and they've invited me to come, and their billing is three conservatives and a very brave liberal. And that's about as much billing as I got. And I said to my crew, I guess I'm the liberal. So it's quite known, my politics. But as far as being on the air and things that I moderate, I'm pretty balanced and fair representation.
That's good. I'm going to start the roundtable now, if you don't mind. And this way I've got Gwen Holden Berry, I've got you, and I'm going to bring back Lori. Lori, I think we've got you back.
Hello, Lori.
Lori, are you there? Oh, looks like not. Let me ask you ladies this. While we're getting Lori back on, what I'd like to do is raise the issue that it seems the Republicans are trying a new approach to limiting abortion. I'm sure you've heard the latest wrinkle where they're going to use destruction of evidence as a means of attacking the abortion issue. Have you ladies heard of that?
I have.
Yes, I have. In fact, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Susan.
Well, I was going to say, I'm trying to recall what state it is. I want to say Arkansas, but there's a piece of legislation that actually a woman, woman representative has put forth this bill that she's sponsoring that basically says that you cannot abort a fetus that is a result of a rape or incest because that fetus is evidence in the case. And the only way to find out, the results of that pregnancy is after the child is born, or the results of the rape, or I guess it would be just the rape, by the way.
I'm sorry, I had to step away for a second. Gwen, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it's wrong. What they're doing is. I think basically this is about control. It's a woman's rights, and Roe versus Wade was already been through the courts. I think it's Utah that this state representative, I forget her name, is.
I'm going to look it up while we're talking.
Yeah, I was trying to hear myself. No. It's basically, I think it's wrong, Rick. I always think it's wrong. It's a woman's right to make the choice. It's in the end and in the beginning, especially in the case of rape or act of violence. And in that case, too, to suggest that anything else would be criminal on her part. Abortion would be a criminal act on top of a crime that's been committed against her. It's abhorrent to me.
Okay.
Well, I think the bill actually focuses on the doctor. If the doctor is the one who performs the abortion, it's the doctor who goes to jail. I don't believe it's the woman. I believe it's the doctor, and that's the focus.
Okay. It's still wrong. I still think it's wrong, and it puts the woman who has had already an act of violence committed against her, now she's subjected to more emotional violence by the state.
Okay.
Well, I don't think it goes beyond that. Go ahead. It's New Mexico, by the way.
Okay, great.
We were both a little off.
either one of those three states, Arkansas, Utah, New
it
Mexico.
Yeah, in fact, it was House Bill 206, introduced by State Rep. Catherine Brown, would charge a rape victim who ended her pregnancy with a third-degree felony for tampering with evidence.
Right, yeah.
Okay, I think I've got Lori back. Hold on one second. Lori, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. A little technical snafu there.
That's okay.
But I've had some excellent help over here in the studio. So let me ask you this. Ladies, I'd like you to weigh in on this bank settlement that just went down.
Bank settlement.
Where the banks have been asked to just pay a small amount of money, and they're off the hook on the mortgage problem.
Oh, yeah. They got away scot-free, and no one goes to jail, of course. It's ridiculous. But, I have an odd theory about Barack Obama anyway. I think he was just allowed to win and put in there to pardon the previous administration and just keep things the way they are for the ruling elite, which is what he's done. And the social equality moves, such as gay rights and so forth, I think that was a matter of evolution of the society. And notice he didn't try for that right off the bat anyway. It was after he was sort of pushed into that. I didn't
by
see
Mr.
him
Biden.
Come out swinging on that. I'm sorry?
I said by Mr. Biden's leaked
right.
comment.
Right, and I think there is an evolution because of pop culture shows and all that. I think the sentiment evolved to for equality. But, you know, the social equality, I'm glad for those moves, the Lilly Ledbetter and all that. However, I still contend that he was allowed to win and to keep the wars going, to keep the contractors going. He has done nothing different from George W. Bush except perhaps the no waterboarding going on, you know, but that had to stop anyway because that's torture. I really don't see any difference between the two policy-wise. I don't anyway. So he accelerated the drone wars. He forgave everybody if the CIA for the waterboarding. I mean,
except the whistleblowers.
Oh, yeah, except for them. Yeah, so I really just see that, you know, he made some kind of deal. And if you look at all the graphs on the wages and all that and the elite, it's all stayed the same or gotten worse, you know, worse from a progressive view than from Bush. I mean, there's been no change.
Susan, let me ask you a question, if I may. Out on the west coast of Florida in the Sarasota area, are you seeing housing prices rise or are the foreclosures continuing?
Well, housing prices are definitely getting better in our area. We're a coastal community, so we tend to do better at a faster rate than most. So housing prices are going up. There are still foreclosures. I have three in my neighborhood where they've been living in their homes for, you know, over a year and a half without paying any mortgages. So I'm anticipating that the banks are not dumping everything all at once, and they're just staggering it in order to help the housing market. But that being said, you know, the amount of time that a home sits on the market is not that long anymore. Where it could have sat for a year, on average, it's 3 months here, which isn't bad.
Gwen, you mentioned that part of the reason why you had to move was mortgage-related issues. Is that correct? Did I understand you correctly?
Yes. Yes, you did. The house that I was renting, which is really just across the street, I really like my neighborhood, is in foreclosure, and it was in foreclosure. It's been in foreclosure for well over a year. The last couple of months I was there, I saved my money to move. I didn't pay the landlord. The landlords or the owners of homes that are rented out, a second property type of thing, there's a lot of renter beware on that score too, you know, because people are renting homes that are in foreclosure. The people pay their first, last, and security, get in there, and then, you know, a month later, the bank comes with a notice.
There was a story through Bill Moyers. He was talking with Matt Taibbi, and he was a journalist. Matt Taibbi assesses the Obama administration's approach to holding banks accountable for their behavior, and early indications are not promising. Taibbi tells Bill that fearing another economic calamity is no excuse for turning a blind eye to shocking unethical decisions in management. Moyer says it's time to talk with journalist Taibbi, and he says you're working on a story right now that's come out a couple weeks about the HSBC settlement. Can you tell me why that interests you? And Taibbi says, well, the HSBC settlement was really shocking, a kind of new low in the history of too big to fail. HSBC was a serial offender on the money laundering score. They've been twice given formal cease and desist orders by the government, once dating back as far as 2003, another in 2010 for inadequately policing the accounts of their system. They laundered over $800 million for the cartels in Colombia. Yes, drug cartels in Colombia and Mexico. They laundered money for terrorists connected to bankers in the Middle East, Russian gangsters. Literally, you know, he talked to one prosecutor who's like, they've broken every rule in the book. They did business with every kind of criminal, and they got a complete and total walk. I mean, they had to pay a fine. Do you see in your interaction with people a concern about this complete breakdown of the judicial system? Let me ask you first, Susan Nylon.
Well, you know, I think this has been consistent since 2008, when everybody expected there to be arrests. I mean, if you compare it to the savings and loan scandal, where not only were there arrests, there were trials and there were jail time and a complete overhaul. This time around, you know, nobody's bothered with very much. I don't know why. I don't know why this administration hasn't been focusing on it the way that it did during the, or the way that the previous administrations did during the SNL scandal. Are people concerned with it? I think they're learning to live with the fact that they never anticipate anyone to pay any penalties. I think they believe that the government believes that they're too big to fail. I don't think the people do, but I hear a certain sense of complacency because it's been how many years now? What are we on, our fifth year? And nothing's really been done, and Bank of America is still able to function. I have people, I won't name them, but people that are friends of mine, and they make their checks payable to Bank of America every week with their paycheck or their mortgage check. And I say to them, why do you even bank with them? And they give you all the reasons in the world. It's easy, online checking, online banking, et cetera, without any regard of the damage that Bank of America and other banks have done to our system. We tried this really big push. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Go ahead and finish your comment.
Well, there's a big push for local community banks, but even then that starts to wane as well. I think people are just moving on.
Lori, let me ask you the same thing. Are you hearing from your activist community about any resistance to this banks get a free pass kind of thinking?
Well, the banks are getting a free pass, but I kind of look at it to the administration. Just recalling what I said a few minutes ago about the deal that was cut, most of the people Barack Obama selected have all been from other corporations that have carried out other egregious acts, if not what Bank of America did. Then, you know, he has Citigroup people and J.P. Morgan people and Goldman Sachs people. And the point I'm making about that is something I came up with that I put on my website may be relevant. He could have taken Barack Obama executive action with the foreclosures to allow judges to have flexibility when people came before them with foreclosures. There are some judges that, if we read some items, that were very sympathetic to the people before them and not the banks, but their hands were tied. Now, he wanted to take executive orders on gun controls and so forth. Okay, people can decide on, debate on that, but why not executive orders when he got in right away before the Tea Party took hold, where people of all sides of the political spectrum had problems with the banks back then and would have loved to have seen, you know, stemming these foreclosures. You know what I'm saying? So the point I'm making is I think some of this goes back to the administration, not, you know, they obviously let them off scot-free. And as, you know, Susan was saying, the other guest here, saying that, you know, during the savings and loan scandal, people did go to jail. Well, I think the deal's been cut where nothing is being done with the people. Were outraged, but nothing is done against these bankers.
Gwen, let me ask you: when you talk to people, are they noticing that there seems to be one level of justice for the rich and one level of justice for working people?
Absolutely. I'm going to say, you know, I used to be somebody who said, you know, you got to do the due diligence whenever anybody spoke in terms of conspiracy. However, the point is that I think it goes beyond, especially from our government's point of view, it goes beyond our borders, and it's systemic within a global economic overview by 1% of the population on the planet that has always been there. And it's time to bring the door open on all of that. And while groups like Occupy are fighting to do so, everyday people, if that's a good term to use, I hope it is, who have who have children to raise and have to go to work in the morning and come home in the evening and give love and care to their families and don't have time to listen to all of the different conspiracy theories, or you know, they're just going to sit down and watch, you know, 2 and a Half Men and perhaps The Good Wife or whatever. And when the trouble arises for them with a bank or what, then they'll face it. Other than that, they see what's going on maybe on the side, but unless they're in an activist community, they're not, you know, don't let it touch me is where it's coming from. I think it's our government is controlled. I really do anymore. I think it's about money. It's the bottom line. The corporations are running it.
Well, you know, this HSBC here, they're doing business with the biggest bugaboo, the drug people, the terrorist people, and they're walking away. We see the LIBOR scandal where these people are playing games with everyone's credit scores everywhere, and they're walking away. I asked Raul Grijalva, you know, did he think that what's happening is really poisoning the justice system of America? It is going to be bringing a generation of people to their adulthood with absolutely no illusion that the game is rigged, that there's one justice for the rich and one justice for the poor. And he's a positivist. He looked at it positively. He said, but I'll tell you what, on my office wall, there's a picture of a young man who was given 3-year prison sentence for a joint. And also right next to it, a picture of someone who got a 3-year sentence for stealing $3 million. And he said, clearly, we need to fix this. This needs to be changed. But he's a long-term thinker, and he looks at it in the positive that there are more people getting involved. And I think that's all to the good. Absolutely. But I'm just very concerned that those of us who pay attention are looking at this situation and this, you know, the blinders are off. There is just not the same justice.
Rick, so you have to take into consideration, and on the positive, while I just laid out that I think that, the system, the government, it's all rigged. In fact, I'm someone who doesn't even think borders are good anymore. I will say this, more and more every day people are waking up, and that's the only way to term it, is awakening. Ask Susan, ask Lori. I'm sure they see people who look up and say, well, what do you mean? What's going on? Or the people who are getting caught up in this. And they wake up, and somebody new wakes up because they wake them up. It is happening, but on the whole, it's still a pretty large battle to put the truth out there, and they're not getting it from the MSM. I mean, hey, I heard David Schuster, big commentator, over on Current Television actually come out and say news is a product. I mean, come on.
Yeah, if you see the film Network, it's not even a parody anymore. It's just business as usual. Another question I want to ask everybody is Michelle Rhee, the famous promoter of commercials education and charter schools, just came out with an incredible nationwide service. She's evaluated every educational system in every state of the union. I would assume that this is completely non-biased, wouldn't you? Let me ask. Start with the comments from Ms. Price, Lori.
I don't know about the survey. I'll just assert my ignorance of this topic right now, but. In terms of her, from my listening to her on various shows and charter schools and all that, I mainly see them as a way to sap the money and the strength from public education. And I'm not saying that there aren't some exceptional charter schools or that some people haven't benefited or anything like that. However, the plan to basically, tout it on Fox News 24/7 of charter schools and, you know, basically the taxpayers give wealthy people a stipend so that kids can go to charter schools and private schools. It zaps the strength of the public education, but it's not one of my fields of expertise, but that's on the surface what I see it to be.
Ms. Nylon?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was watching a documentary about Michelle Rhee and what she did in D.C. Only on, I guess, like 2 weeks ago on Frontline. And, you know, while I appreciate her passion in wanting to take what appears to be a broken school system, I agree. I have mixed emotions about charter schools. I'm a very big fan of public schools, and I think by creating a private industry in education and making that the focus of the state, we're really not doing a service to the public schools, and we're setting them up to fail. I'm not privy to her survey either, and I tend to be a little bit leery of them because showed in her study of what she did in D.C. that the way she set her reward system up for the teachers, a lot of it was falsified in order
right,
for the teachers
exactly.
to win the awards. And that
right.
tends to be, that happens here, whether it's, you know, with our grading system and our FCAT, there are plenty of opportunity here for teachers just to totally focus on the exam because their merit pay is attached to how well their students do. And students in the same token, the fact that they have to pass this exam in order to be promoted to the next grade, the parents tend to let it slide as well. And do we hold the charter schools up to the same effort? Not all of them. You know, they have, if you teach in a private school, they have a certain type of testing, but the focus isn't the same as it is in the public school. So I think it's an incredibly unfair advantage. On the flip side, as a parent, my son is about ready to head into high school next year. I'm looking around at all the schools, and chances are he's going to go to the public school that I went to here. But in a large consideration, I'm looking at not only the charter schools, the private schools, but also the magnet schools as well, because I want him to be in the best school possible for him. So there's always that you know, that balance that you have to understand.
Gwen, any thoughts?
Well, I came out of private schools, and in fact, same alma mater as Ms. Rhee with my college degree. But I got to say this: I think of what Naomi Klein brought out in her shock doctrine about the privatization of schools and the profiteering of corporations in it, and I have to agree with what Lori was saying in the beginning, very much so.
Go ahead.
I don't have any children, so my friends, they enjoy, in fact, one of my best friends works for the public school system down here, and I think public schools deserve, because they're community, you know, they're part of the community, they deserve our support. And so do the teachers. And I'm just simply not educated enough in how they work and what's going on with them right now on an individual. And you have to take things individually many times. I don't think that the privatization of schooling is overall a good idea, because it's gradually saying, well, if you can't afford an education, then you can go work at McDonald's.
Here's a little excerpt of an article about this report in the Washington Post. Ms. Rhee went on to form Student First and pledged to raise $1 billion to upend the public education system, according to her reform taste. Those include merit pay for teachers, which has been tried over decades and never worked, using standardized tests to evaluate educators, which assessment experts say is a bad idea, charter school expansion, voucher expansion, the weakening of teachers' unions. Rhee says these reforms will improve education, while critics say they're harming it and they're really serving to privatize the public education system. Implementation of these reforms and other measures were the prism through which Student First graded the states. Nearly 90% of them got less than a C. 11 states got an F. In Ms. Rhee's grading system, the D.C. school system that's implementing her reforms got a higher grade than the states of Maryland and Virginia, which consistently are at or near the top of high-performing states. And Virginia, Maryland got a D+, Virginia got a D-. The district, the urban system with the highest achievement gap in the country, it got a C+. The states that got the highest scores handed out, a B- were Florida and Louisiana. No big surprise there. So this sort of shows you that Let's see. Do you think maybe she set out to prove that her ways are best? I would suspect that that's probably the case. Let me ask you another question. You know, our country's embarked, it seems, on a path of punishing whistleblowers and giving a pass to those who've actually done the damage. What kind of impact do you think this is going to have in the long run? And let me start with Gwen this time.
You know, I have a dear friend in Massachusetts who was shocked to learn this weekend that her graduating grandson from high school at 18, who's exemplary in football and was looking at a scholarship, actually surprised everybody and enlisted in the Marines because somebody told him that's as good as he could get. I think it's damaging, and of course it's breaking apart the aspiration and inspiration that youth has, and those young people right now who are in college are getting very jaded. You know, kids in college now join social clubs in order to ensure that they're going to get a job on coming out. Most of these clubs are conservative and Christian-based in certain parts of the country. When I hear things like that, it freaks me out because it was the exact opposite when I was in school. I really don't know what it's doing, but Rick, I do think that there's positive changes going on because all of this is catalyzing or focusing on the negative so clearly that something's got to give on a huge level. That's the only thing I can think positive about.
Lori, do you have any thoughts on that arena?
Yes, I think that we're going to need dramatic social change coming forward, and I think the whistleblowers, you know, my site, I do praise, imply, and almost openly praise the actions of Jeremy Hammond and so forth and others on some of these release of these documents, because one time I put a comment up on the site that it's too bad they didn't release the Cheney Energy Task Force documents, which probably, no, that probably would have been the huge, you know, ties to 9/11, which, you know, I guess sadly the truther movement became associated with the right wing, but I was very early out questioning 9/11 being an inside operation. You really look at all the facts as an aside with 9/11, and there's some very serious questions what happened that day all around, and too many people benefited, in especially with the security industrial complex and all that. But anyway, getting to what I'm saying, if they release those documents where Cheney went hunting with Scalia and then they kept him secret, imagine that if Barack Obama had a secret document, we go in a war, there's no weapons found. Imagine what they'd be saying about Barack Obama. I'm just saying, I know he's doing the drones and all that, but can you imagine if it was him instead of George W. Bush that went into a war? Look at the Benghazi uproar when there's no real investigation to 9/11, that whitewash and all that. I'm just saying if they hacked the original Cheney Energy Task Force documents, I think people would have been up in arms about Enron. The whole thing was connected, and going in there and Unocal and Afghanistan, the pipeline, and the Taliban actually got like $42 million from the U.S. in April of, I think, 01, and they said, we'll carpet you with bombs or carpet you with gold, and they didn't want that pipeline, and then suddenly the Taliban's the big enemy when they were friends with the Bushes and all that. I mean, I'm just saying the whole thing is connected, and I think the whistleblowers are important to get people, and I don't think these petitions these days are working. I think we need massive social change. There's a mouthful.
Absolutely. Gwen,
right.
Any thoughts?
I agree. I completely agree. Absolutely, 100% agree.
You know, unfortunately, the propaganda machines that have Private Manning convicted before any trial, including comments by our constitutionally educated president, where he said that he was guilty before the trial, Julian Assange not allowed a day in court, instead being forced to seek asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy. It does not bode well for our system of justice. And, you know, many people who urged the election of Barack Obama said, well, you know, we'll have a much better choice at even-handed justices in the Supreme Court if we elect him as opposed to Romney. But you have to wonder, given the kind of justice we've seen, that the rich do no wrong, the oil companies, the banks are doing nothing that should be prosecuted. Oh, my God, it's so difficult to prosecute those bankers. We just can't be bothered. It certainly looks like we need something significant to change. And, of course, you need a catalyst for that. Let me ask you another question. It seems that with Mali and Somalia and Algeria being on the periphery of the news, that the next big military push, if not in Iran, will be in Africa. What are your thoughts about the looming dangers of the resource-rich and government infrastructure-poor nations of Africa? Is that where AFRICOM is going to be the new Middle East? Let me start with Lori.
Definitely, you know, wherever there's resources and these corporations find they want something, we're there. You know, I mean, the excuses come out of why we went there after we go. You know, if a corporation wants us there and they saw that model work in Iraq and they kept, if you remember early on, the caskets couldn't be shown. They learned from Vietnam. What they learned from Vietnam, the people in charge of the same wars, was not about not going into wars that don't make sense, but to keep the media covered. And then you have the embeds covering these wars. Now, if you're with a bunch of soldiers day in and day out, even if I was there, I'd be sympathetic towards the people working hard. I mean, that's why they do the embeds, and so you don't get the real stories about the war crimes and all that. I'm just saying they got it all worked out. It's what these corporations want. And it's amazing. And, yes, I think AFRICOM, definitely. And, by the way, in the CLG website logs, you should see some of the military things there with Pentagon headquarters, even in Guantanamo and all that. I've seen them all in the logs. And I know where all our bases are, what's in our logs. So I've seen the AFRICOM and all that. So, yeah, that's probably where we're going.
Gwen, let me go to you next. Thank you, Lori.
Sure.
I'm out of my league there because I'm really not up on what's going on over there. What I do know this though, they have armies peopled with children over in that territory, and when things start to blow up over there with our soldiers, our military, and there's dead little children soldiers on the ground, that could be a strong catalyst. So we really do need a paradigm shift. Something's going to give.
Well, you know, the one thing about war is there's always jobs for soldiers, aren't there? Susan, let me ask you, do you have any thoughts on the Africa front?
Well, I mean, let's just put it in perspective. They are there in support of the French army at this point in time. And, you know, that was once a colony that they're focusing on. And I guess my question is, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm not as definitive as others on this call about. I mean, I'm against wars that are serve no purpose, but in the same token, when we have allies that are asking for our help and that we have an invested interest in it, it's just I tend to err a little bit on the side of caution before we know exactly what's happening, before we jump to any conclusions. It is a very fragile area. There are 7 fragile African states that are a part of this whole effort, and I'm not certain at this point why the French are in there other than just to protect their own interests, and they asked our help. So, but I don't know enough about it. I know there's a lot of Al-Qaeda that are there and are led to believe that that's where their new home is. So, but other than that, I don't know.
Well, caution's always a reasonable position. we have so many areas where our resources are called upon. You know, it seems to me that at some point we need to have a discussion of what is the line we're going to draw on America as the world's policeman. Are we going to become the world's mercenary? Are we going to just hire out our army? Are we going to subcontract to XE or Blackwater, whatever their this week's slogan is? It seems to me we need to think seriously about where our resources go when we're told that there's no limit on our war expenditures, on our mercenary expenditures, the Defense Department taking the big lion's share of our national budget, but there's no funds available for medical. There's no funds available for education. I remember hearing a speech by a Florida politician a couple years back. He said, we can cut taxes tremendously in this state and they'll have no impact on police or fire, libraries or schools, which tended to be, in fact, completely erroneous. Do you think there's room for a national discussion on where are America's international interests? Let me start with Gwen this time.
Well, there's always room for that discussion, but who's listening and who's doing the discussing? You know, when we discuss it, I'm much aligned with you, Rick. I wonder at our expenditures for military and for going out to plunder resources from other spaces on the planet when we have a large problem with our own national local sustainability as far as good health, filling the bellies of children who are starving in our own towns and cities. I mean, I feel like it's ludicrous for us to be out there spending all this money on military. Why can't we lead with the greatest example to be set in history by saying we're going to take all of this money that goes to our military and we're going to help put it back to putting our own nation back together and stop being that world policeman? Frankly, well, that's where I'm coming from.
Thank you. Thank you, Gwen. Lori, you want to pick up on that?
Yes. I mean, we have to see that the military, I think it's starting to evolve or, you know, I'm not sure when it started, maybe in the 1950s, but the creation of a boogeyman, you know, whether it was communism and then the war on drugs, which worked out so well, and then turns out all the banks are funneling the money to keep the drugs, you know, as we discussed earlier. But I'm starting to see that it's whatever these large corporations want us to appear. And I think France recently, this week, it was the first time French troops went in support of a corporation at a uranium mine. And the new boogeyman of Al-Qaeda, which literally means the database, and I wonder, I think it was the CIA's database in the 1980s of the Mujahideen, whatever. But the thing I'm saying is this Al-Qaeda is the new boogeyman, and when that's done, it'll move on to some other new thing. And I think it's just really to support where we can get the oil or the minerals or wherever. And I think people have to look at what's driving these wars. And by the way, the prison industrial complex is tying into the same people making a profit on that to keep the drug law severe, to keep people in these private prisons, you know, the prisons for profit, whatever. I think it's all getting tied in together with these corporations just making mountains and mountains of money, putting it overseas and, you know, not investing here. And that's where we have to start, is putting these corporations on a leash of some kind. I think you'll see a lot less wars when we do.
Susan,
I think that's the next goal.
Susan, can I ask you, how do you think we can encourage a national dialogue on America's international relations and America's international responsibilities? What form do you think that might take?
Well, I think when we have any kind of dialogue, we have to be completely realistic about it, and we often talk about the military-industrial complex and how it affects us in our foreign countries. But the truth of the matter is, there's a lot of communities within the United States that depend on the military. You know, when we have a manufacturing deficit in our country, and the only thing we really produce in a lot of communities are weapons, are planes, are things that the military uses. And when we put ourselves in a position that, you know, we have senators and representatives that are up on the Capitol Hill and say, you can't, the military has to order these planes because I know you don't need them, but I have an entire community that depends on them to work. And in the same token, when we start to cut the defense, which I believe we have the largest defense cut spending this past month, and the economy, the numbers dropped. And why is that? Because we have communities that are dependent on that. So, you know, it's great to say we shouldn't be fighting all these wars. We shouldn't be the police state of you know, the world. But the truth of the matter is, until we improve our home economy, what are we going to do with these families who work for Boeing, who work for GE and all the other industries that provide for the military? When they start cutting back, they lose their jobs. We're going to have poor people from that as well. Kids aren't going to be able to be fed at night, and families are going to lose the roof over their heads. I'm not supporting that we should remain in war because of this. I'm just saying we have to be realistic that we're borrowing from Peter to pay Paul.
A solution is to retool those industries, those very industries.
Absolutely.
For green industry, for the things we really need to clean this planet up.
Well, I would argue that there's enough room for infrastructure improvement that we could be building bulldozers and cranes and earth movers for us and rebuilding our bridges and roads like we're doing after we blew up all those facilities in Iraq and Afghanistan. But
yes,
I was trying
–
go ahead.
You'd have to convince the people that this change that you want to happen will work. You know, I worked in the construction industry right before 2008, and everything went belly up. And to me, the most logical thing was for everyone who worked in the construction industry was to move over their talents into the renewable energy industry. So I thought it was a no-brainer. Not only did our state legislation not agree with me, but there weren't people on the ground asking that to happen either. You know, it takes an education. And when we have you know, people in the media, people in the legislature, you know, people that are working against that whole global warming theory and in the renewable energy industry, you know, it's hard to convince someone who has been doing the same job year after year after year to learn something new and on the whim that it's going to work.
Well, I can appreciate that.
You know,
what I was really trying to aim for was, would it be built around an election? Would it be built around some international forum? I mean, one would have hoped that since we've just nominated a Secretary of the State and we're in the process of nominating a Secretary of Defense, that there'd be room for some of that kind of discussion there, when in fact we've seen what the posturing fools have done with those dialogues. Well, as we're wrapping up, I do want to ask each of you to talk a little bit about the work that you do. I try to be brief. I know, Susan, you have a wonderful show. Laura, you've got a wonderful site. Gwen, you have a wonderful site. So let me start first with our first guest of the evening. Gwen, talk a little about your website, your blog or your podcast. Let's hear a little bit about Here Be Monsters.
Here Be Monsters is a blog talk show also, and we have four different shows going on. It on Sunday is the most relevant show. Our Sunday show is right before you, Rick, and Jack Dodell.
And a great show it is.
I host guests much like yourself with progressive, liberal, and a lot of activism. In fact, we have some of the XL pipeline.
Try to be brief.
Out in Texas, some of those activists coming on next week, so tune in for it.
Thanks very much. Susan?
You can find me every day, Monday through Friday at 5 o'clock on the Internet, Sarasota Talk Radio, or if you're in Sarasota, you can find me on WSRQ Radio, 106.9 FM and 1220 AM.
Thank you, Susan. Lori?
Yes. I have a newsletter that I compile with stories and some snippy little comments. We sometimes call Obama Obusha. Don't get mad. But anyway, you can go to www.legitgov.org and subscribe for the newsletter, or just visit the site just to see what we're about. Thank you.
Thank you all so much for joining me. I want to mention that next week we have a wonderful show. We'll be talking with some people on security issues. We also have Alan Hendricks, who's running for office. So thanks so much for joining me tonight, and we'll see you next week. Thanks to all our guests, Lori Price from Citizens for Legitimate Government, Susan Nylon of the Nylon Report, and Gwen Holden Berry of There Be Monsters. Thanks again so much, ladies. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. What in heaven's name brought you to Casablanca?
My health. I came to Casablanca for the waters.
The waters? What waters? We're in the desert.
I was misinformed.
They said the students scared the guard, though the troops were battle-dressed. The poor mothers and their nudity, the bachelor's. I know we're all fed up with useless wars and racial strife. The next time they will ride, well, you best stay out of sight. When there's a ride going on, when there's a ride going on.
Thanks so much. We'll see you next week.